Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody, this is Pascal, another episode of Disrupt Disruption. I am stoked to have Massimo Porticasso with me. Massimo is the chairman of Hello Tomorrow, a deep tech community, also a former long-term partner at BCG, focused on deep tech. And we will dig into this topic of deep tech today on this podcast to explore why deep tech is not just technology, but also a new approach to innovation. Massimo also has done extensive work on nature co-design, so we might touch a little bit on this as well. Massimo, I'm stoked to have you. Thank you for being here.
Same here. Really looking forward to the conversation.
Let me start with my typically first question, which is, I'm curious how, in your world, you define and think even about innovation disruption. Now, these different things are these things you actively drive versus stuff which happens to you. How do you think about this?
The difference that I would put, and this brings me toward the deep tech part, actually, it's a very nice segue. But to me, innovation is everything which is new, and it could be 10% new, it could be 100% new. So everything that is new is innovative by definition, but disruptive is probably what I would say my threshold is one order of magnitude different or better. This is what disruption is. And that's where I tend to calibrate the two between innovative. You can be innovative doing things at the margin and still being innovative. Being disruptive, you really need to change the log scale. So go from one order of magnitude to the
In terms of disruption then, do you think this is something you can be planful, thoughtful, or is this something which tends to happen through the larger shifts in the landscape or in the market?
It's happening. You cannot force disruption. It's happening. But you can, if you want to have an emergent approach toward disruption, and you can nurture it for it to happen. So you need to ride on waves that are happening. And currently, there is a big wave that is happening. We talk about the fourth wave of innovation, which is a disruptive one in its essence.
So you had me at the edge of the seat when we did the pre-conversation talking about deep tech and your particular stance on deep tech. You know, it's kind of funny. We talk about disruption as this tofu word. It kind of doesn't mean anything anymore. It's similar to tofu doesn't taste like anything. And deep tech feels to me, at least the word deep tech, feels to me a little bit like tofu as well. Everybody likes to throw it around. Nobody really defines it typically. Let's start out with, like, how do you, as a practitioner in the field, think about deep tech? And then I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on why deep tech is a new way of innovating.
Yeah, and I'll take a very small detour. I'm going to get back to this immediately, but I'll take a smart historical detour because you need to put things in context. As you were saying, disruption doesn't happen. It really emerges out of major trends that are happening. And what we need to consider is this particular historical moment in which we are right now, because we are in what we call the fourth wave of innovation. And basically, if you go back, you had the first and the second wave, the first wave of innovation, which was the first and the second industrial revolution. This is what laid the foundation for the current and modern civilization. And this was the time where chemistry got kind of invented, or industrial chemistry, electricity came, and the internal combustion engine, and many other things. This lasted till after Second World War happened, the second wave of innovation, which was fueled by the war and many other things. And this was the time where you had the big labs creating and driving innovation together with the state. You had the Bell Labs, you had Xerox PARC, you have IBM really doing great research together with the state. And this is the wave that literally brought us to the moon and gave us the ultimately. This wave lasted till the 70s, but then there was a change in regulation and many other things. And this wave went down and the third wave started, which is the wave that we know as of today in terms of innovation and also disruption. If you want, it was the digital wave. So we went from the computer to the personal computer, then mobile, then cloud. And this is the wave that was mostly fueled by venture. What is happening now is that after those three waves, we're entering a new wave of innovation in which we are basically bringing together and closing the circle. So we're going back to the first and the second industrial revolution, but we're building on top of it the old digital part, and we're going to a world in which innovation is happening at the bits which has been happening in the past decades, and atoms. And we're bringing innovation with those two elements together, and it's happening. And this gives a completely different nuance and meaning to the whole innovation wave that is happening, because we have the opportunity and the possibility and the necessity to literally redo the world. And this is what is happening with deep tech right now. So this is this kind of contextualized, this is what is happening in terms of deep tech and why this is happening. But it still doesn't describe it. Means, okay, but what is deep tech ultimately? And this is something that I had exactly the same reaction. I've been hearing people talking about deep tech. We started talking about deep tech back in 2017. So when nobody was talking about it, and I can tell you, we were among the ones really starting pushing the word. And it was just basically a reaction because everybody was talking about digital startups. And if you did an app to order food for your pets, that was kind of disruptive innovation. And it was a bit of a reaction because there were a lot of scientists really working to change the world for the better. And it was coming from that place. And initially we started looking at technology, but ultimately, and this was a bit the realization that we had in the last report, we came to the conclusion that deep tech is not about technology. The same way Christensen, when he speaks about technology, doesn't say there is a disruptive technology. Technology is a technology. The way the use you make of it is disruptive. The same is true for deep tech. It's not that the technology is a deep technology or not. The use you make of it lead to a deep tech, what we call approach toward innovation. And what is this deep tech approach toward? The deep tech approach toward innovation, we spoke about the bits and atoms for sure. So there is a physical component. But what really characterized this approach toward innovation is basically three things. The first thing is that the barriers to innovation fallen dramatically, both at the computational side, but also in terms of labs and so on. So it is possible today to do things where before you would have needed major investment in CapEx to be able to do it. It's not only true on the computational side. This is also happening on the wet lab side and many other things. So this is falling barriers. But the real two key driver for this new approach toward innovation is that on the one side with deep tech, what is happening is that the option space is dramatically expanding. Is dramatically expanding to a place that you can move to a place where your default innovation is not the incremental innovation we were talking about, but becomes fundamental and radical innovation. And you can have innovation in terms of orders of magnitude. And this expansion of the option space is basically driven by two convergences. The first convergence is the convergence of approaches. What is happening today is that you have science, which is coming together with design. So the idea of problem orientation, design thinking, but not applied only to UX, UI, and digital, but applied real world and science and deep science. And the two are kind of brought together with engineering. And you have this convergence of science, design, and engineering coming into one place. And if you bring the three together, then you can come to solution that normally you wouldn't have come to, because the scientist is in his own world or the designer doesn't have the scientific knowledge to be able to do it. And if you bring this together, you can come to solution that you wouldn't have thought of before. Mm-hmm. This is one convergence. And the second convergence, which is as important as the first one, is that we have a convergence of technologies. I think Atsim speaks about it in his book as well. But the way we characterize it is that you have basically three main domains. You have cognition and computation, which is the whole AI quantum when it comes apart. And this is where we've been talking a lot about. You have the other one that I define it as sensing and motion, which is very much robotics. And at the intersection of the two, you have things like self-driving vehicles, unmanned aerial vehicles, not vehicles, but drones, basically, and all of these. And this is what people tends to think about. What is happening today and what is specific of this time and this kind of innovation is that the third dimension is coming into place, which is what we call matter and energy. And matter and energy used to be a constant or a constraint in the innovation process. It's now becoming, and you're adding basically dimensionality to your innovation space if you bring these three together. And when you bring them together, then you have this explosion of innovation. And you can see this with synthetic biology. Why is synthetic biology happening? You have the advancement on the matter side, so on the biology side with CRISPR and many other things, and you have a lot of AI coming into place, but people tend to forget that the old robotic automation that is happening in the high throughput screening is what is enabling these very quick DBTL cycles that are allowing to get to a very different kind of innovation. So these two convergences, science, design, and engineering, and the three domain of technology coming together in one place are completely expanding the option space. So this is one thing that is happening. But what is happening at the same time, it goes in a, not an opposite direction, but what is happening is that while we are expanding the option space, because we are applying the design, build, test, learn cycle to all of these, because we have engineering building the bridge between science and design, we apply design, build, test, learn. And for each of the step of the cycle, you have amplifier that are have been built in the design side. You have a generative approach that allows you to create way more solution. In the build and test, you have robotics that allows you to have high throughput and you can be faster. You can have 3D. And then you have learn. You can apply, generate more data, learn better, generate better. And then you can quickly go through this cycle. And what it means is that ultimately, through the DBTL, you are collapsing the time. So things that used to take 20 years, new materials, new stuff, are now getting in the range of 2 years. So again, one order of magnitude reduction. So you have one order of magnitude expansion, one order of magnitude reduction, and you can imagine what it means. It literally means that we can make things possible that were unthinkable short ago.
Let me dig into this a little bit more. I'm absolutely fascinated by this. And when you talked about the first order of magnitude, and the shift there, and talking about the multidisciplinary approach, presumably that is relatively hard to do, right? Because you need to bring very diverse skill sets together, probably also domains which haven't historically in an established company, for example, never really worked together. How do you approach that?
That's a very good question. And this is also what makes successful team versus not so successful team, because teams that are really strong on one side don't manage to get to the breakthrough that are necessary to be able to move forward. And one way to do it is really to nurture a very strong, you know, the so-called T profile, where you have one area where you're really deep and you have the knowledge, but you have on the surface, you understand the language of others. You're not an expert, but you can understand what the other are saying. There are people are going to say that you are going to have a pi version where you have a double vertical, but those are really the super skilled people. But even a T is enough. You don't need to have the pi. And this, then you can connect the T, and then out of these, then you can generate these. I think this is a very, very important part, because otherwise you end up in the science paradox where you know more and more of less, and that's not where you want to go. You really want to take the science, apply to a problem, and you create the engineered solution to be able to really deliver on that.
So if I were the leader of an incumbent organization, I'm buying into your model, which I clearly am. So how do I go about this? What would you give me as advice, as in, like, here's a couple of things you really want to think about, you really want to put into place to be successful and to position yourself in the right way for this new...
And that's the perfect question, because you can imagine you have these, you know, you have this small space, you expand it, and the time is getting super, super faster. So what do I do? How can I orient myself in this new space? And the answer is problem orientation. Go back to the original problem. Because what is happening and what is limiting a lot of incumbents is that they have created a mental frame of living in a solution. But you don't need to live in a solution. It's just like Rilke when he was talking, let's leave the question. And they really need to leave the problem and go back to the problem, not to the, because you are already reducing. If you operate at the solution level and try to make the solution a little bit better, you're going to get incremental. But if you go back to the problem and then you look at all the possible solutions, then you really are going to bring together things that you wouldn't have used otherwise. And the biggest innovation is going to come in combining stuff, not just completely inventing new stuff, is combining stuff. Look at what happened with GPU and AI. It happened that these processors were really good for that, and this is, gave an incredible boost. So this is really where you really need to free yourself from the constraint of operating in terms of solutions, but starting to think about the problem.
I'm curious if I could dig into this a little bit more. This is a recurring theme, by the way, on this interview series we have, where we hear this over and over again, that people tell us, rightfully, I'm 100% sure, you have to go back to the problem. You know, we heard people think that they're a paperclip company, but they're actually, clearly, you're not a paperclip company. You're doing something to solve a customer problem. If you were to sit down with the innovation leader or the CEO, the board of a company, how do you get them to do that? How do you go back to the problem? And then I've got a follow-up question, which is, in the deep tech world, again, like, I think the challenge might be for many companies, and you pointed this out, right? The multidisciplinary approach. So I'm curious to, as a follow-up question, to hear your thoughts on, do you think this is something you want to actually do in-house, as in you want to have all these skills and processes, et cetera, in-house? Or is this actually an approach which shouts out more towards a networked economy where you become part of a, whatever the term you want to use, platform?
So the answer to the first question is, I think it's a matter of mental frame of reference. Mm. If you ask me, is the same way, you know, by Amazon, one of the principles is don't accept the proxy, mm-hmm. don't accept the process as a proxy for what you're trying to do. The same is true here. Yeah. It's really a mindset, is what is the problem that we're trying to solve here? And keeping on asking this question, I think, is important, and getting rid of the constraint that have been built or the mental frames that you have been building over years, which were absolutely appropriate back then, it looks like in ancient times, but not long ago, it was absolutely okay to have this concept because it was a stable environment and so on. But now you need to really go back to, it's another overused term, but first principle. Yeah. But I would say the first problem, I would talk about first problem instead of first principle. What is the problem, yeah. So to say, to use a kind of German word. So this is the one thing. It's just really this obsession. What is the problem that we're trying to solve? Back to the other point that you have, you're absolutely right. And one of the characteristics of this deep tech innovation approach is it's not something that by definition you can have all in-house. It's too complex. You really need to have these network open innovation ecosystem approach, and you really need another big effort. You need to start thinking in terms of, instead of getting the biggest slice of the pie, you really need to start thinking about how can I make the pie as big as possible, and with that have my slice grow. And the only way to do it is really having open innovation, is another overused term, but you will never be able to have all the knowledge in-house, and you really need to build a network, and the way your company is going to be structured is going to be also way more networked than it is today.
If you look at the yin to the yang, here's the things you should do and which you need to put into place to be successful. If you were to look at, here's the common pitfalls I'm seeing, the challenges which companies might stumble over. Do you have quote unquote, a list of the, here's the 1, 2, 3 things you really need to look out for the moment you embark on this journey?
To be sincere, I might have it, but I don't think that this is going to be helpful. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that there are very good reasons why people are falling into the pitfalls. Mm-hmm. And you really need to look at the environment and change the environment to avoid that you fall into the pitfalls. Trying to avoid to fall into the pitfalls only is going to lead you to falling into the pitfalls. You know, I started a company once, and I had the list of the 10 things I shall not do. Absolutely. Yeah. I did all of them. And I knew very well that those were the things I didn't need to do. But because the overall environment led me to do those mistakes. So yeah. The advice that I would give people is really to go back and ask you the question and really iterate, think in terms of network. But you need to go one level deeper. Having the list of the pitfalls to avoid is going to lead you to fall into these pitfalls somehow, because you are mentally relying on these boxes, and this is not what you need. What you need is taking a step back and find your way through these with the right mindset.
It's interesting. It reminds me too, I did once advanced driver's ed, and they teach you how to not crash into a tree, basically, when you drive, like your car slides. And the most important thing they tell you is don't look at the tree. You need to look at the gap, because that's where the car will go. If you look at the tree, the car will inevitably crash into the tree. That is fascinating. I've never thought about it that way. That's really interesting. Massimo, I'm curious, if we're going back to the deep tech conversation, because I'm just so fascinated by this. What do you think is the broad range of applications of this? How prevalent will this be in terms of industries being affected by it? Is this something where you think Well, this is going to, you know, clearly it's going to be a big deal in specific industries like life sciences, for example. Or do you have the feeling that this is actually going to like be much broader and sweeping through many, many, many more industries and thus probably requires us to be much more vigilant as a company to keep our eyes open and not just say, oh, this is something for the guys in life sciences. I get it. But like, I'm fine. I make paper clips.
I think if you're doing paper clips, you should really, really look at this still. And what I mean by that is, and this is why I wanted to give the historical context, because it's really important to see this in context. But we started with a model with the first and the second industrial revolution, which was based, because of the science of the time, on a very strong exploitative model. And what we have the possibility to do now is something very different. And I'll go back to the exploitative in a second. But basically what is happening, because of this convergence, because of this advancement, because of what is happening is that for the first time, we can leverage nature as an engineering and manufacturing platform, which brings me to my nature co-design place. And because we can use nature to as an engineering and manufacturing part, we have the possibility to redo the underlying foundation of our modern industrial civilization. And I'm not exaggerating, because it's really a huge, huge, huge shift. And what I like to compare is basically you need to consider the shift that we are undergoing right now, and it's starting now, and we have basically 2 decades to get this one right. Otherwise, we are not going to have a planet after that, or a planet, an habitable planet. We're going to still have a planet, but we might not be able to live on it. But basically, what the transition that we're going through now is, in my view, comparable, and I'm not exaggerating, to the one where we went from being hunters and gatherers to becoming farmers, to a place where we are becoming hunter and going from being hunters and gatherers of resources to becoming farmer, but at the atomic level. This is the shift where we're going through now. And this is going to impact everything, everything. And from synthetic biology to the way you do membrane to produce hydrogen, the way you produce energy, the whole foundation has been built in the first and second industrial revolution based on an exploitative model. Internal combustion engine. It's always going from something bigger to something smaller. And now we have the possibility to do the reverse and really start at the atomic level and going from smaller to bigger and build. And this is the only way to do it sustainably over time, because you really have this generative approach. And I use the word on purpose, generative and not regenerative, because I don't want people to think that this is only about circular economy. Yeah. Ultimately, we will not be able to create things out of nothing. So there is always a regenerative component into that. But I really love to emphasize that this idea of generative is that we can create product from the atom up and build it and redo it. It's not happening in 1 year. It's not happening in 5. It's going to take a decade or so. But as it took 40 years to do this digital transformation, it's not going to take 40. It's going to take 20, ideally 10, because we really don't have the time to wait for 40 years to be able to do so. And you start, if you see the way what is happening with precision fermentation and the way we're replacing meat or cultivated meat, the way we are basically going from energy produced using fossil fuel to using renewables is just, you know, if you look at solar energy, is transforming photons into electrons. It's going from smaller to bigger. So this whole idea of redoing the foundation of our economy and the industrial economical tissue is really at the core of it. And every company, there is no one company that is not going to be affected by this transition that we need to go through. We don't have an alternative.
Massimo, this is an absolutely fantastic conversation. I could have this conversation truly for the next 3 hours. But let me ask you a closing question. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. I like to ask this question always as my closing question. And I'm have an inkling that you have a very interesting perspective on this, which is, for me, the question is always, when we talk about this innovation and disruption topic, and in your case, clearly the deep tech innovation as a sweeping new methodology and a sweeping new approach to it, how bullish or bearish are you that existing incumbent companies can actually do this?
I'm both. Okay. I'm both. And what I mean by that is I literally had a workshop this morning with a big cosmetic company and really tried to convince them that they need to do it. They might be able to do it. They might be not. But as in every economical transition, there are going to be winners and losers. So some will get it and it's possible. What I want to say, it's possible to do it, but you need to have the gut to really embrace these, and you really need to have the strength to free yourself from the constraints and the mindset in which you are and reimagine things. It's a huge exercise of reimagination. You will not be able to do this if you try to do more of the same or a little bit more in a slightly different way. It will require a big step back. And I think that the burden is very much on the leadership in these companies, right, because they will have to set the frame for people to be able to read it. They will need to create the space for people to do and make this transition.
Massimo, what a fantastic conversation. Personally, so much in the relatively short period of time we had together. I absolutely love the idea and the concept around looking at deep tech, not just as, yes, it's another technology or another set of technologies, but really embedding it in the much broader context of innovation and disruption. I love your metaphor of don't look at the don't do list, because you will hit that don't do list inevitably. It really struck something with me. I just want to pull this out. Really enjoyed your description of the first principles as the first problems, or actually the Ur problems, as a as a German. I'm already in love with that. Massimo, this was amazing. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Really, really enjoyed this.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p@finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.